Today is July 13th, the year 2001. We're in East Lansing, Michigan. I am Jeff Charnley interviewing Robert Underwood for the Michigan State University Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of Michigan State to be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, Mr. Underwood, we have a tape recorder for this oral history today. Do you give us permission to tape this interview?
Sure do.
Okay. I'd like to start first with a little bit about your personal educational background and your personal background. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to school?
Well, I was born and raised right here in Lansing. I find that I'm one of the few people that worked at Michigan State that did happen to grow up in this area. I went to Lansing Eastern High School, and then I went to Michigan State University, graduating in 1958. Then I left the university after graduation for work at the Northern Illinois University, DeKalb, Illinois. I did that until 1960 and then returned here and worked for 37 years, retiring in 1997.
Mm-hmm. What did you major in?
I majored in, at that time it was called Hotel, Restaurant, and Institutional Management.
Okay.
It's now referred to as the School of Hospitality Business.
Mm-hmm. What directed you in that area?
Actually, one of my uncles was Robert Linton, and Robert Linton was the registrar at Michigan State University for probably 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Linton Hall here on campus is named after Uncle Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And one day in the summer, we were having a family picnic, and I was a sophomore. And Uncle Bob said, "What are you going to do with your life?" And I said, "I don't really know." And he said, "Well, Dr. Hanna and I happen to think that the hotel and the restaurant business is going to really take off in the next couple decades. Why don't you enroll in the Hotel, Restaurant, and Institutional Management School?" And I said, "Okay." And that was my guidance counseling got me into this business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Had you had any experience in working in a hotel or anything prior to that?
No, not really. Actually, my first job was working at Michigan State University when I was about 14.
Mm-hmm.
I started working here as a high school student custodian in Berkey Hall.
Mm.
So that was a connection I had with the university, but I worked in grocery stores and gas stations and stuff like that. Didn't do anything in the hospitality business at all.
Mm-hmm. What was campus like when you first got here?
Oh, gee, that would depend on when I first got here.
Well, you're right. When you came as a student, not when you were a janitor in Berkey Hall.
Well, it wasn't too much south of the river at that time. The dairy barn was still up across the street from Shaw Hall, and Shaw Hall was fairly new at that time. Brody was pretty new. None of the residence hall facilities that we have south of the Red Cedar River were here. Registration took place in the auditorium. It was the same type of registration that took place for the next, I don't know how many years. It was a long time.
Yeah, until about 92.
Yeah, until that thing was changed over. Spent a lot of time in what was called the South Campus Grill, and on the land currently used by the International Center, there were a whole series of temporary buildings in there. And I think it was called, what did they call that? The Ag School had a short-term program over there for students who wanted to come to Michigan State but had to be home for harvest and had to be home for planting.
Planting? Mm-hmm.
Short course.
Okay.
It was called a short course area, and there were barracks type buildings over there, and then they had a big building called a short course cafeteria, I think, or a South Campus Grill.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hung out in there. I was a commuter student, so I didn't really make a lot of contacts here on campus at that time, did not live in a residence hall system.
Mm-hmm.
as I've tried to encourage my grandchildren, don't do that. Mm-hmm. We're going to have them coming to Michigan State soon, and they'll be staying in the residence hall system. Because you really don't get the chance to meet very many people when you do that. So mm-hmm. my college experience was commuting on a regular basis, hanging out with the students and the kids that I went to high school with pretty much. And then about halfway through college, I got married. So it was,
mm-hmm. And did you live in married housing? Or?
Yeah, we lived in married housing for mm-hmm. a while. But only after I came back from... I didn't live in I lived in faculty housing then.
Oh, okay.
But no, I didn't live in married housing from 1957 to 1958. That's when I was married and we were finishing up then. I lived in Lansing. Mm-hmm. But it was smaller, that's mm-hmm. for sure.
Did you have any contacts with, let's go back to your undergrad education. Were there any faculty mentors that you had that stand out?
One of the standouts that I had was a professor named Lumiansky, and he was an ATL professor. Okay. And then I had Robert Jones, was an accounting professor who single-handedly got me through accounting 101. I remember that. And there were numerous professors that were very helpful. Once I got into what we called the upper school at that point in time, once you declared a major, you were a junior, senior, then you met up with the faculty members in the School of Hotel Restaurant mm-hmm. Institutional Management. Mm-hmm. Bernard Prue was still a strong influence in that school at that time. And there were other faculty members, a man named Eaton, who taught, I think it was kind of a mechanical maintenance course that you took. If you wanted to be a hotel manager, you had to know about heating and air conditioning and plumbing and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he taught a course like that. So those were sort of the standout people that I remember.
How was it that you got your first job at Northern Illinois?
Well, in 1958, the country was in a little bit of a recession, and all of those jobs that I had foreseen in the bright lights of the hotel and the restaurant business weren't developing. People were laying off, and so I interviewed with a fellow who used to work at Michigan State. His name was Paul Fairbrook. Paul had been a night auditor over at, or the controller over at the Kellogg Center, and he happened to be manager of food service at Northern Illinois University, and I went down there because that was the only job available at that time. Mm-hmm. That got me into the, and I was the manager of a student union down there. Mm. Didn't know much. Mm-hmm. I got to that job, and Paul said, well, I have kind of good news and bad news. The bad news is the union manager quit and is leaving in 2 weeks. And the good news is you're going to be the interim manager of the reunion. Well, there wasn't much I could do about it other than just be a little bit nervous because I fresh out of school and all of that. And, mm-hmm. It had some work at Kellogg Center experience and front desk and so on, but this was primarily a food service job, and I didn't know very much about food service. Took it anyway, yeah. And that's how I got down there. A
lot of on-the-job training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the employees of that place really were very good to me. They taught me a lot.
Mm-hmm. And how was it that you came back to Michigan State?
Well, my wife did not like the flat corn country of central Illinois, or northern Illinois if you would like, and her family was back in this part of the state, and so I called a friend of mine who was well known here on campus named Bob Emerson. He was the manager of Kellogg Center for many years, and I had worked for him for the last couple of years that I was on campus. And I asked Bob if there were any job opportunities in Michigan, and he found three job opportunities for me to interview for. Two of them were with the Michigan prison system. One was with the Michigan prison system in food service, and one was a food service job at the Kellogg Biological Experimental Station, KBS. I don't think they called it that then, but and one was working in the residence halls here on campus. And after interviewing for those, I said, well, Robert, what do you think I should do? And he said, I think I'd take the one on campus. And they hired me really on the basis of the notion that Dr. Hanna and Emery Foster and Lyle Thorburn, who were managing the system at that time, knew that the great leap in enrollment for the baby boomers were starting, and that construction was going to grow. And at that time, Michigan State, I think, had visions of being a mega university of 60 or 70,000. So they just hired me without quite, you know, without a job. I just knew that the jobs were going to start coming. Mm-hmm. So I started out as a food supervisor in Brody.
Was Brody new then?
No, Brody was built in 1954.
Oh, okay. All right.
In that area, so it was fairly new. At the time, it was touted as the largest non-military food service in the world. So we played on that reputation for a long time over there.
Presumably the food was better than in the military.
Presumably, yeah. Yeah, right, right.
What were your duties?
Well, when I got there, I really didn't have any, so the manager of the food service said you better start getting some experience in the various parts of the back of the house. So I worked as a baker for a few weeks and as a cook for a few weeks and out in the dining room and in the dish room and in the pots and pans and in the menu planning and did some interviewing with students in the dining room about what they liked and what they didn't like about the food service. And I did that for a few months, and then the management of Brody turned over. The manager left to go to a job in Arizona, and the head building supervisor left to go to work in California. And so the fellow that I was working with, Mr. Ted Smith, became manager of Brody, and they created a job called assistant manager, and I got that job. So I wasn't in the food service very long before I moved into that.
And that was involving supervising an office or offices or both?
That job was supervising the crew that took care of the maintenance of the buildings, the custodial.
Okay.
And the maintenance of all of the seven buildings in the Brody complex. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting job. It was a large group of people. There were six or seven supervisors in those buildings. Each building had its own supervisor and its own crew that took care of the public areas. And I don't think we were doing any student room cleaning at that time. I think students were responsible. But there were community baths and showers in all of those buildings, and that's the kind of work that these folks took care of. Mm-hmm. Then there was summer painting and maintenance and scrubbing and so on.
How long were you at Brody?
I was there until 1961, maybe winter term of 1962, I can't really remember. Mm-hmm. And I went over to Case Hall as the manager of Case Hall. I didn't open up Case Hall, which opened up in the fall of 61, I think. And I stayed in there until I think I got there in January of 62. And then in the fall of 63, I opened up Wonders Hall. Mm-hmm. Wonders, and we were building one and two residence halls at a time then. Mm-hmm. In 1961, we opened up Case Hall. In 1962, we opened up Wilson Hall. In 1963, we opened up Wonders and McDonald Hall. Mm-hmm. And in 1964, we opened up Fee and Acres. And I think Holmes Hall in 65 and Hubbard Hall in 66 and Holden Hall in 67, something like that. It was a fantastic growth period for us.
How did the students respond to that?
Oh, the students didn't know any different. I mean, the thing about dealing with the students in the residence halls is that you really only have basically the students for 2 years. Mm-hmm. There's a certain thing about the notion of maturing. I watched it over these 37 years, and that is you come in as a freshman and you do a lot of kind of silly freshman stuff. And you live in the residence halls, and by the time you get to be a sophomore, you begin to think that you don't want to live in the residence halls anymore and that you are old enough to become independent. So you start thinking about moving off campus. Well, in those days, if you were a freshman, you had to live in the residence halls, and you may still have to. I don't know what the rules are now. But you also had to live in the residence halls if you were a sophomore. So we had a lot of reluctant sophomores, put it that way. But then as juniors, you have a tendency to move off. And so you have a constant flow of fresh customers. You know, and these are really customers. In the housing business and in the food service business, you have to make people understand that the reason that they're there is because the students are there. Now, other parts of the university might feel that the students are there because they are there, all right? And that's fine, I don't argue with that. But without the students, the housing and food service operation would cease to exist, so we have always taken the position that we're there to provide service to the students. So we would have a fresh group of customers every year, and we were housing, in the peak years, 19,000 students just in the residence halls. A lot of them three to a room. I mean, university was packing this place, and we had the freshman rule, so, you know, it was sort of catch-22 for the kids. You had to live in the residence halls, but there was not enough room for everybody to live in a double, so that meant there was some tripling up. And that in and of itself created a lot of problems. It created a huge amount of problems for the mothers as they arrived on campus and saw how little space that students had to live in.
The mothers objected
strenuously to that. Some of them did, even with a lot of prior warning. And as soon as the parents sort of got out of town, the students began adjusting to one another. And it wasn't not very long before when it came time for the students to move into double rooms. And there was a certain attrition rate, you know, with students here. Often they couldn't decide who would want to move. Who of the three students in the room, they become good friends and become accustomed to one another and one another's company and so on. So sometimes it was difficult for them to decide whether or not they wanted to move and then who of the three would move. That was kind of the thing that we did from, 1961 right on through beyond 1967, 68, 69. You'd have to look at the enrollment trends to see when that started to fall off. But at that point in time, it was a struggle just to get people fed. There were so many people just getting through the meal. Each meal period was a challenge. It's much better now, I must say, because there are fewer students, a lot of single rooms, a lot of doubles, nobody's tripled up. The students have a ton of options in terms of the meal plans that they have. They can eat anywhere they want to on campus.
It wasn't that way in
the 60s? It was not that way, no. In the 60s, we did not have multiple meal choices at mealtime. You came through, and you had a dinner entree. If it was Friday, you had a meat dish and a fish dish. You had maybe one dessert, you had one salad, and it could have one of everything. It could make two glasses of milk, so everything was limited. That was the way contract food service worked all over the United States. And Michigan State, through the leadership of a man named Emory Foster, who was the he was called Manager of Dormitories and Food Services at that time. And his most immediate right-hand person was another man named Lyle Thorburn, both of whom are deceased now. Emory was manager of the whole system, which included residence halls and university apartments, the Union Building, Kellogg Center, food stores, and those kinds of things. And Lyle Thorburn was the manager of residence halls, which is the single largest unit of housing and food service, still is. They introduced choices, food choices, where you would have maybe two or three choices of entrees, two or three choices of desserts, two or three choices of salads. And then from that grew, but it was still limited in terms of the numbers that you could take. Mm-hmm. So you always had to deal with the kids who were trying to sneak more food than that. And then you had to deal with the football players who were bigger than everybody else and needed more food and would always, try to take more than, quote, what they were allowed. Until we moved into the unlimited food service that you have right now, where students can eat anywhere they want to, anytime, depending upon the meal plan that they have, and huge varieties of foods. It just progressed and grew, and colleges and universities all over the United States learned that it became easier and easier to deal with multiple choice menus. It was cheaper. Cheaper in the sense that you could serve, if you were serving a roast beef dinner, then everybody had roast beef, and so your cost was fixed at roast beef. But if you serve roast beef and a macaroni and cheese, a lot of people would take the macaroni and cheese, which is, you know, common sense tells you that's a lesser lesser expensive entree mm-hmm. item. Mm-hmm. So you could combine, you could save, and any kind of waste that you had into it or other costs that were associated with a multiple choice menu were leveled off because people were eating a combination of expensive entrees and inexpensive mm-hmm. entrees. That's kind of the way that
was there less waste with the new system? Or
yeah.
No? Yeah,
there's less waste, and there was less waste when once people could take all they wanted, mm-hmm. then we emphasized take what you want, but eat what you take. Mm-hmm. And we reduce portion sizes at that point in time because the students could come back for it. And then a lot of things became self-service. Mm-hmm. At the same time of all of this growth, about 1965, I think we became unionized. And we might have had our first contract in 1965. You'd have to check with the union historians here on campus. Mm-hmm. When that occurred, then our labor costs began to rise sharply. And so instead of having a person serving salads and a lot of person at every station behind the hot food line serving, somebody serving mashed potatoes and somebody serving corn and somebody serving the entree, it got very expensive to do that. And so the industry and Michigan State moved towards self-service items. You didn't draw milk for people anymore. They put the milk in the dining room. You began to put soft drinks in the dining room. And so I think at one time, probably still is, you know, students have the variety of maybe 15, 16, or 20 different beverage choices. Mm-hmm. You go to a salad bar now and make your salad. And a lot of the places on campus that now you serve your own entree. Mm-hmm. It's just a big buffet. So all of that driven by labor cost. And you know, when I started out, we were paying people $1.25 an hour. And a week's vacation after they had worked 5 years or something like that, it was a very, and I don't think any medical benefits were paid at that time. Mm-hmm. Until you look at the wages today and look at the fringe benefit package and the retirement package that's paid, and then you look at how much has the room and board rate gone up in comparison to the cost of having an employee on hand, and you'll see that the cost of the employee has gone up more than percentage-wise than the room and board rate has gone up in the way you compensate for that is reduced labor. When I helped negotiate some of the first contracts, that was sort of a side thing that I did. Just volunteered to do that is to help out the university and have a representative. We were a major employer, Housing and Food Service, had 1,000 bargained for employees at that time. These were not supervisory employees, but this was the basic custodial food service worker. We had 1,000 people. Today, I think that's probably close to 400. But they work more efficiently. The services have changed. But if you look at their rate of pay now, and I wouldn't quote their rate of pay because I've been away from it so long, I don't know, but it's very high, probably 10 to 15 times more expensive now to put somebody in one of those jobs than it was in the 60s.
Were students employed a lot?
We used a lot of it. One of the philosophies that we had were that student employment was a great educational opportunity. Many of the students came to us never having worked before. So our philosophy for jobs in the housing system was, since the students are paying the room and board fees, then the priority for jobs went to students who live in the residence halls. And you could be an excellent employee, and once you moved out of the residence halls, you lost your priority for a job. Didn't mean you lose the job. If we had all the jobs filled with on-campus students, then you lost your job. But chances are a good employee who worked for us for 2 years would have moved up into a student supervisory position and was living off campus. You couldn't take a freshman student and put him in a supervisory position right off the bat. But we used a lot of students, and as time went by, as it became very, very expensive to use regular labor, then our student labor increased. But at the same time, a lot of the work went away because of self-service and stuff like that.
But students continue to be employed because of benefit packages, their financial aid, or
not so much. That was never a factor. There were a lot of. It's really funny. It's sort of like any other government program. But if you get a student aid, if you're a department and you get a certain amount of student aid, then you're going to hire students and you're going to use that aid to offset your budget. Okay. There's no such offset in the Housing and Food Service because all you take, the only funding you get is what you take in. You know, it's a business. I used to say all of our money comes in through the cash register, and that might be the registrar's cash register, you know, where they're collecting room and board, or it might be the cash register, a real cash register someplace. But that was our income. And we had we didn't use student aid. We really didn't want to use these aid packages because it augmented our labor cost. And we always thought at some point in time that's going to go away. That's not always going to be there. So if you built your business around a heavily subsidized student labor program and all of a sudden that goes away, then all of a sudden you're in asking the students who come the next year to start paying more money to make up for the aid that has been dropped off. And so we never really got into that. The primary thing was you live in a residence hall, you can work in the residence halls. And I think they still have the same philosophy. It's hard to get students to work now. I think it's a mistake, but.
Especially for those that didn't have much experience, work experience prior to college.
Well, it's a mistake. What's a mistake now is that I think students are in high school. I think parents are told, and I think students through student counselors are told, don't let your student work when they're a freshman. They need that time to study. And that is the worst advice that you can possibly give, because they don't use that time to study. They watch soap operas and waste it. all you got to do is sit down and figure out how many hours are there in a week? How many hours are there in a day? How many hours are you in class? How many hours would you sleep? It's not very much with college students. Mm-hmm. And so how much time do you have left over to study? How much realistically are you going to study? And the balance, you can work. And there's a lot of time there for that.
Mm-hmm. In your career, after you left some of the individual residence halls, how did that change?
Oh, well, in 1963, I was manager of Wonders, and then 64, 65, I got promoted to a job called area manager, because we had grown so big that we had to have, the complexes had to have some sort of leadership in them. So South Campus had four buildings at that time, and East Campus had four buildings at that time, and then we had North Campus over here that had always been, and then we had
West Circle Dorm?
Yeah, West Circle, and then mm-hmm. you had Mason Abbott, Snyder Phillips, and Shaw. And so we took those areas and we created a whole series of area managers. And these were line managers to whom the managers of the units reported. We didn't figure that was a full-time job. So each of us had some staff responsibility. And my staff responsibility was to be responsible for the building maintenance for the whole housing area.
For all dorms?
For all.
Oh, okay.
For all of them. Now, that wasn't a line management job. I didn't direct mm-hmm. it, but I had to be sort of the resident expert, the person that you went to. We had another one of our areas.